This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents Jane in Search of a Job, a short story by Agatha Christie, performed by Hugh Fraser.
Jane in Search of a Job. Jane Cleveland rustled the pages of the Daily Leader and sighed. A deep sigh that came from the innermost recesses of her being. She looked with distaste at the marble-topped table, the poached egg on toast which reposed on it, and the small pot of tea. Not because she was not hungry. That was far from being the case. Jane was extremely hungry. At that moment, she felt like consuming a pound and a half of well-cooked beefsteak, with chipped potatoes and possibly French beans, the whole washed down with some more exciting vintage than tea. But young women, whose exchequers are in a parlous condition, cannot be choosers. Jane was lucky to be able to order a poached egg and a pot of tea. It seemed unlikely that she would be able to do so tomorrow. That is, unless... She turned once more to the advertisement columns of the Daily Leader. To put it plainly, Jane was out of a job, and the position was becoming acute. Already the genteel lady who presided over the shabby boarding-house was looking askance at this particular young woman. And yet, said Jane to herself, throwing up her chin indignantly, which was a habit of hers, and yet I'm intelligent, and good-looking, and well-educated. What more does anyone want? According to the Daily Leader, they seem to want shorthand typists of vast experience, managers for business houses with a little capital to invest, ladies to share in the profits of poultry farming, here again a little capital was required, and innumerable cooks, housemaids, and parlourmaids, particularly parlourmaids. I wouldn't mind being a parlourmaid, said Jane to herself, but then again, no one would take me without experience. I could go somewhere, I dare say, as a willing young girl, but they don't pay willing young girls anything to speak of. She sighed again, propped the paper up in front of her, and attacked the poached egg with all the vigour of healthy youth. When the last mouthful had been dispatched, she turned the paper and studied the agony and personal column whilst she drank her tea. The agony column was always the last hope. Had she but possessed a couple of £1,000, the thing would have been easy enough. There were at least 7 unique opportunities, all yielding not less than £3,000 a year. Jane's lip curled a little. If I had £2,000, she murmured, it wouldn't be easy to separate me from it. She cast her eyes rapidly down to the bottom of the column and ascended with the ease born of long practice. There was the lady who gave such wonderful prices for cast-off clothing, ladies' wardrobes inspected at their own dwellings. There were gentlemen who bought anything, but principally teeth. There were ladies of title going abroad who would dispose of their furs at a ridiculous figure. There was the distressed clergyman, and the hard-working widow, and the disabled officer, all needing sums varying from £50 to £2,000. And then, suddenly, Jane came to an abrupt halt. She put down her teacup and read the advertisement through again. There's a catch in it, of course, she murmured. There's always a catch in these sort of things. I shall have to be careful. But still. The advertisement which so intrigued Jane Cleveland ran as follows. If a young lady of 25 to 30 years of age, eyes dark blue, very fair hair, black lashes and brows, straight nose, slim figure, height 5 feet 7 inches, good mimic, and able to speak French, will call at 7 Endersley Street between 5 and 6 p.m., she will hear of something to her advantage. Guileless Gwendolyn, or Why Young Girls Go Wrong, murmured Jane. I shall certainly have to be careful, but there are too many specifications, really, for that sort of thing. I wonder now. Let us overhaul the catalogue. She proceeded to do so. 25 to 30. I'm 26. Eyes dark blue, that's right. Hair very fair. Black lashes and brows, all okay. Straight nose? Yes, straight enough. Doesn't hook or turn up. And I've got a slim figure. Slim even for nowadays. I'm only 5 feet 6 inches, but I could wear high heels. I am a good mimic. Nothing wonderful, but I can copy people's voices. and I speak French like an angel, or a Frenchwoman. In fact, I'm absolutely the goods. They ought to tumble over themselves with delight when I turn up. Jane Cleveland, go in and win. Resolutely, Jane tore out the advertisement and placed it in her handbag. Then she demanded her bill, with a new briskness in her voice. At 5:10, Jane was reconnoitering in the neighbourhood of Endersley Street. Endersley Street itself is a small street, sandwiched between two larger streets in the neighbourhood of Oxford Circus. It is drab, but respectable. Number 7 seemed in no way different from the neighbouring houses. It was composed, like they were, of offices. But looking up at it, it dawned upon Jane for the first time that she was not the only blue-eyed, fair-haired, straight-nosed, slim-figured girl of between 25 and 30 years of age. London was evidently full of such girls, and 40 or 50 of them at least were grouped outside Number 7 Endersley Street. "Competition," said Jane. "I'd better join the queue quickly." She did so, just as 3 more girls turned the corner of the street. Others followed them. Jane amused herself by taking stock of her immediate neighbours. In each case, she managed to find something wrong. Fair eyelashes instead of dark, eyes more grey than blue, fair hair that owed its fairness to art and not to nature, interesting variations in noses, and figures that only an all-embracing charity could have described as slim. Jane's spirits rose. "I believe I've got as good an all-round chance as anyone," she murmured to herself. "I wonder what it's all about. A beauty chorus, I hope." The queue was moving slowly but steadily forward. Presently, a second stream of girls began issuing from inside the house. Some of them tossed their heads. Some of them smirked. "Rejected," said Jane with glee. "I hope to goodness they won't be full up before I get in." And still the queue of girls moved forwards. There were anxious glances in tiny mirrors and a frenzied powdering of noses. Lipsticks were brandished freely. "I wish I had a smarter hat," said Jane to herself sadly. At last it was her turn. Inside the door of the house was a glass door at one side with the legend Messrs. Cuthbertson inscribed on it. It was through this glass door that the applicants were passing one by one. Jane's turn came. She drew a deep breath and entered. Inside was an outer office, obviously intended for clerks. At the end was another glass door. Jane was directed to pass through this, and did so. She found herself in a smaller room. There was a big desk in it, and behind the desk was a keen-eyed man of middle age, with a thick, rather foreign-looking moustache. His glance swept over Jane. Then he pointed to a door on the left. "Wait in there, please," he said crisply. Jane obeyed. The apartment she entered was already occupied. 5 girls sat there, all very upright and all glaring at each other. It was clear to Jane that she had been included amongst the likely candidates, and her spirits rose. Nevertheless, she was forced to admit that these 5 girls were equally eligible with herself, as far as the terms of the advertisement went. The time passed. Streams of girls were evidently passing through the inner office. Most of them were dismissed through another door giving onto the corridor. But every now and then a recruit arrived to swell the select assembly. At 6:30, there were 14 girls assembled there. Jane heard a murmur of voices from the inner office, and then the foreign-looking gentleman, whom she had nicknamed in her mind the Colonel, owing to the military character of his moustache, appeared in the doorway.
"I will see you ladies one at a time, if you please," he announced, "in the order in which you arrived, please."
Jane was, of course, the 6th on the list. 20 minutes elapsed before she was called in. The Colonel was standing with his hands behind his back. He put her through a rapid catechism, tested her knowledge of French, and measured her height.
"It is possible, mademoiselle," he said in French, "that you may suit. I do not know, but it is possible."
"What is this post, if I may ask?" said Jane bluntly. He shrugged his shoulders.
"That I cannot tell you as yet. If you are chosen, then you shall know."
"It seems very mysterious," objected Jane.
"I couldn't possibly take up anything without knowing all about it. Is it connected with the stage, may I ask?"
"The stage? Indeed, no." "Oh," said Jane, rather taken aback. He was looking at her keenly. You have intelligence, yes? And discretion?
I have quantities of intelligence and discretion, said Jane calmly. Now what about the pay?
The pay will amount to £2,000 for a fortnight's work.
Oh, said Jane faintly. She was too taken aback by the munificence of the sum named to recover all at once. The Colonel resumed speaking.
One other young lady I have already selected. You and she are equally suitable. There may be others I have not yet seen. I will give you instruction as to your further proceedings. You know Harridge's Hotel?
Jane gasped. Who in England did not know Harridge's Hotel? That famous hostelry, situated modestly in a by-street of Mayfair, where notabilities and royalties arrived and departed as a matter of course. Only this morning Jane had read of the arrival of the Grand Duchess Paulina of Ostrova. She had come over to open a big bazaar in aid of Russian refugees, and was, of course, staying at Harridge's.
Yes, said Jane, in answer to the Colonel's question. Very good. Go there. Ask for Count Streptich. Send up your card. You have a card?
Jane produced one. The Colonel took it from her, and inscribed in the corner a minute P. He handed the card back to her.
That ensures that the Count will see you. He will understand that you come from me. The final decision lies with him. And another. If he considers you suitable, he will explain matters to you, and you can accept or decline his proposal. Is that satisfactory?
Perfectly satisfactory, said Jane. So far, she murmured to herself as she emerged into the street, I can't see the catch. And yet there must be one. There's no such thing as money for nothing. It must be crime. There's nothing else left. Her spirits rose. In moderation, Jane did not object to crime. The papers had been full lately of the exploits of various girl bandits. Jane had seriously thought of becoming one, if all else failed. She entered the exclusive portals of Harridge's with slight trepidation. More than ever, she wished that she had a new hat. But she walked bravely up to the bureau and produced her card and asked for Count Streptich, without a shade of hesitation in her manner. She fancied that the clerk looked at her rather curiously. He took the card, however, and gave it to a small page-boy with some low-voiced instructions, which Jane did not catch. Presently the page returned, and Jane was invited to accompany him. They went up in the lift and along a corridor to some big double doors where the page knocked. A moment later, Jane found herself in a big room, facing a tall, thin man with a fair beard, who was holding her card in a languid, white hand.
A Miss Jane Cleveland, he read slowly. I am Count Streptich.
His lips parted suddenly in what was presumably intended to be a smile, disclosing two rows of white, even teeth, but no effect of merriment was obtained.
I understand that you applied in answer to our advertisement, continued the Count. The good Colonel Cranin sent you on here.
He was a colonel, thought Jane, pleased with her perspicacity, but she merely bowed her head.
You will pardon me if I ask you a few questions.
He did not wait for a reply, but proceeded to put Jane through a catechism very similar to that of Colonel Cranin. Her replies seemed to satisfy him. He nodded his head once or twice.
I will ask you now, mademoiselle, to walk to the door and back again slowly.
Perhaps they want me to be a mannequin, thought Jane, as she complied. But they wouldn't pay £2,000 to a mannequin. Still, I suppose I'd better not ask questions yet a while. Count Streptich was frowning. He tapped on the table with his white fingers. Suddenly he rose, and opening the door of an adjoining room, he spoke to someone inside. He returned to his seat, and a short, middle-aged lady came through the door, closing it behind her. She was plump and extremely ugly, but had nevertheless the air of being a person of importance.
Well, Anna Mikhailovna, said the Count, what do you think of her?
The lady looked Jane up and down, much as though the girl had been a waxwork at a show. She made no pretense of any greeting.
She might do, she said at length, Of actual likeness, in the real sense of the word, there is very little. But the figure and the colouring are very good, better than any of the others. What do you think of it, Fyodor Alexandrovich?
I agree with you, Anna Mikhailovna.
Does she speak French?
Her French is excellent.
Jane felt more and more of a dummy. Neither of these strange people appeared to remember that she was a human being.
But will she be discreet?
Asked the lady, frowning heavily at the girl.
This is Princess Poperensky, said Count Streptich to Jane. She asks whether you can be discreet.
Jane addressed her reply to the princess. Until I have had the position explained to me, I can hardly make promises.
It is just what she says there, the little one, remarked the lady. I think she is intelligent, Fyodor Alexandrovich, more intelligent than the others. Tell me, little one, have you also courage?
I don't know, said Jane, puzzled. I don't particularly like being hurt, but I can bear it.
Ah, that is not what I mean. You do not mind danger, no?
Oh, said Jane. Danger? Oh, that's all right. I like danger.
And you are poor? You would like to earn much money?
Try me, said Jane, with something approaching enthusiasm. Count Streptich and Princess Poperensky exchanged glances. Then, simultaneously, they nodded.
Shall I explain matters? Anna Mikhailovna, the former asked. The princess shook her head.
Her Highness wishes to do that herself.
It is unnecessary and unwise.
Nevertheless, those are her commands. I was to bring the girl in as soon as you had done with her.
Streptich shrugged his shoulders. Clearly he was not pleased. Equally clearly he had no intention of disobeying the edict. He turned to Jane.
The Princess Poperensky will present you to Her Highness the Grand Duchess Paulina. Do not be alarmed.
Jane was not in the least alarmed. She was delighted at the idea of being presented to a real live Grand Duchess. There was nothing of the socialist about Jane. For the moment she had even ceased to worry about her hat. The Princess Poperensky led the way, waddling along with a gait that she managed to invest with a certain dignity in spite of adverse circumstances. They passed through the adjoining room, which was a kind of antechamber, and the princess knocked upon a door in the farther wall. A voice from inside replied, and the princess opened the door and passed in, Jane close upon her heels.
"Let me present to you, madame," said the princess in a solemn voice, "Miss Jane Cleveland."
A young woman who had been sitting in a big armchair at the other end of the room jumped up and ran forward. She stared fixedly at Jane for a minute or two, and then laughed merrily.
"But this is splendid, Anna," she replied. "I never imagined we should succeed so well. Come, let us see ourselves side by side."
Taking Jane's arm, she drew the girl across the room, pausing before a full-length mirror which hung on the wall.
"You see," she cried delightedly, "it is a perfect match."
Already, with her first glance at the Grand Duchess Paulina, Jane had begun to understand. The Grand Duchess was a young woman, perhaps a year or two older than Jane. She had the same shade of fair hair and the same slim figure. She was, perhaps, a shade taller. Now that they stood side by side, the likeness was very apparent. Detail for detail, the colouring was almost exactly the same. The Grand Duchess clapped her hands. She seemed an extremely cheerful young woman.
"Nothing could be better," she declared. "You must congratulate Fyodor Alexandrovich for me, Anna. He has done indeed well." "As yet, madame," murmured the princess in a low voice, "this young woman does not know what is required of her." "True," said the Grand Duchess, becoming somewhat calmer in manner. "I forgot. Well, I will enlighten her. Leave us together, Anna Mikhailovna." "But, madame, leave us alone, I say."
She stamped her foot angrily. With considerable reluctance, Anna Mikhailovna left the room. The Grand Duchess sat down and motioned to Jane to do the same.
"They are tiresome, these old women," remarked Paulina. "But one has to have them. Anna Mikhailovna is better than most. Now then, Miss Jane Cleveland. I like the name. I like you, too.
You are sympathetic. I can tell at once if people are sympathetic.
Well, that's very clever of you, ma'am, said Jane, speaking for the first time.
I am clever, said Paulina calmly. Come now, I will explain things to you. Not that there is so much to explain. You know the history of Ostrova? Practically all of my family are dead, massacred by the communists. I am perhaps the last of my line. I am a woman. I cannot sit upon the throne. You'd think they would let me be, but no. Wherever I go, attempts are made to assassinate me. Absurd, is it not? These vodka-soaked brutes never have any sense of proportion.
I see, said Jane, feeling that something was required of her.
For the most part I live in retirement, where I can take precautions, but now and then I have to take part in public ceremonies. While I am here, for instance, I have to attend several semi-public functions. Also in Paris, on my way back. I have an estate in Hungary, you know. The sport there is magnificent.
Is it really? Said Jane. Superb. I adore sport.
Also, I ought not to tell you this, but I shall, because your face is so sympathetic. There are plans being made there, very quietly, you understand. Altogether, it is very important that I should not be assassinated during the next 2 weeks.
But surely the police, began Jane.
The police? Oh, yes, they are very good, I believe. And we, too, we have our spies. It is possible that I shall be forewarned when the attempt is to take place, but then, again, I might not.
She shrugged her shoulders.
I begin to understand, said Jane slowly. You want me to take your place. Only on certain occasions, said the Grand Duchess eagerly. You must be somewhere at hand, you understand. I may require you twice, three times, four times in the next fortnight. Each time it will be upon the occasion of some public function. Naturally, in intimacy of any kind, you could not represent me.
Of course not, agreed Jane.
You will do very well indeed. It was clever of Fyodor Alexandrovich to think of an advertisement, was it not?
Supposing, said Jane, that I get assassinated. The Grand Duchess shrugged her shoulders.
There is the risk, of course, but according to our own secret information, they want to kidnap me, not kill outright. But I will be quite honest. It is always possible that they might throw a bomb.
I see, said Jane. She tried to imitate the light-hearted manner of Paulina. She wanted very much to come to the question of money, but did not quite see how best to introduce the subject. But Paulina saved her the trouble.
We will pay you well, of course, she said carelessly. I cannot remember now exactly how much Fyodor Alexandrovich suggested. We are speaking in francs, or kronen?
Colonel Cranin, said Jane, said something about £2,000.
Oh, that was it, said Paulina, brightening. I remember now. It is enough, I hope? Or would you rather have 3,000?
Well, said Jane, if it's all the same to you, I'd rather have 3,000.
You are businesslike, I see, said the Grand Duchess kindly. I wish I was. But I have no idea of money at all. What I want to have, that is all.
It seemed to Jane a simple but admirable attitude of mind.
And of course, as you say, there is danger,
Paulina continued thoughtfully,
although you do not look to me as though you minded danger.
I do not myself. I hope you do not think that it is because I am a coward that I want you to take my place.
You see, it is most important for Ostrova that I should marry and have at least 2 sons. After that, it does not matter what happens to me.
I see, said Jane.
And you accept?
Yes, said Jane, resolutely. I accept. Paulina clapped her hands vehemently several times. Princess Poperensky appeared immediately.
I have told her all, Anna, announced the Grand Duchess. She will do what we want, and she is to have £3,000. Tell Fyodor to make a note of it. She is really very like me, is she not? I think she is better looking, though.
The princess waddled out of the room and returned with Count Streptich.
"We have arranged everything, Fyodor Alexandrovich," the Grand Duchess said.
He bowed. "Can she play her part, I wonder?" he queried, eyeing Jane doubtfully.
"I'll show you," said the girl suddenly. "You permit, ma'am?" she said to the Grand Duchess.
The latter nodded delightedly. Jane stood up.
"But this is splendid, Anna," she said. "I never imagined we would succeed so well. Come, let us see ourselves side by side."
And as Paulina had done, she drew the other girl to the glass.
"You see, a perfect match."
Words, manner, and gesture, it was an excellent imitation of Paulina's greeting. The princess nodded her head and uttered a grunt of approbation.
"It is good that," she declared. "It would deceive most people." "You are very clever," said Paulina appreciatively. "I could not imitate anyone else to save my life."
Jane believed her. It had already struck her that Paulina was a young woman who was very much herself.
"Anna will arrange details with you," said the Grand Duchess. "Take her into my bedroom, Anna, and try some of my clothes on her."
She nodded a gracious farewell, and Jane was conveyed away by the Princess Bobrovsky.
"This is what Her Highness will wear to open the bazaar," explained the old lady, holding up a daring creation of white and black. "This is in 3 days' time. It may be necessary for you to take her place there. We do not know. We have not yet received information."
At Anna's bidding, Jane slipped off her own shabby garments and tried on the frock. It fitted her perfectly. The other nodded approvingly.
"It is almost perfect. Just a shade long on you, because you are an inch or so shorter than Her Highness."
"Well, that's easily remedied," said Jane quickly. "The Grand Duchess wears low-heeled shoes, I noticed. If I wear the same kind of shoes, but with high heels, it will adjust things nicely." Anna Mikhailovna showed her the shoes that the Grand Duchess usually wore with the dress. Lizard skin, with a strap across. Jane memorized them, and arranged to get a pair just like them, but with different heels.
"It would be well," said Anna Mikhailovna, "for you to have a dress of distinctive colour and material, quite unlike Her Highness's. Then, in case it becomes necessary for you to change places at a moment's notice, the substitution is less likely to be noticed."
Jane thought a minute.
"What about a flame-red maracane? And I might, perhaps, have plain glass pince-nez. That alters the appearance very much."
Both suggestions were approved, and they went into further details. Jane left the hotel with banknotes for £100 in her purse and instructions to purchase the necessary outfit and engage rooms at the Blitz Hotel as Miss Montressor of New York. On the second day after this, Count Streptich called upon her there. "A transformation indeed," he said, as he bowed. Jane made him a mock bow in return. She was enjoying the new clothes and the luxury of her life very much.
"All this is very nice," she sighed, "but I suppose that your visit means I must get busy and earn my money."
"That is so. We have received information. It seems possible that an attempt will be made to kidnap Her Highness on the way home from the bazaar. That is to take place, as you know, at Orion House, which is about 10 miles out of London. Her Highness will be forced to attend the bazaar in person, as the Countess of Anchester, who is promoting it, knows her personally. But the following is the plan I have concocted."
Jane listened attentively as he outlined it to her. She asked a few questions and finally declared that she understood perfectly the part she had to play. The next day dawned bright and clear. A perfect day for one of the great events of the London season, the bazaar at Orion House, promoted by the Countess of Anchester in aid of Ostrovian refugees in this country. Having regard to the uncertainty of the English climate, the bazaar itself took place within the spacious rooms of Orion House, which has been for 500 years in the possession of the Earls of Anchester. Various collections had been loaned, and a charming idea was the gift by 100 society women of 1 pearl each, taken from their own necklaces, each pearl to be sold by auction on the second day. There were also numerous sideshows and attractions in the grounds. Jane was there early, in the role of Miss Montressor. She wore a dress of flame-coloured maracane and a small red cloche hat. On her feet were high-heeled lizard-skin shoes. The arrival of the Grand Duchess Pauline was a great event. She was escorted to the platform and duly presented with a bouquet of roses by a small child. She made a short but charming speech and declared the bazaar open. Count Streptich and Princess Poperensky were in attendance upon her. She wore the dress that Jane had seen, white with a bold design of black, and her hat was a small cloche of black with a profusion of white ospreys hanging over the brim and a tiny lace veil coming halfway down the face. Jane smiled to herself. The Grand Duchess went round the bazaar, visiting every stall, making a few purchases, and being uniformly gracious. Then she prepared to depart. Jane was prompt to take up her cue. She requested a word with the Princess Poperensky, and asked to be presented to the Grand Duchess.
"Ah, yes," said Paulina, in a clear voice. "Miss Montressor, I remember the name. She is an American journalist, I believe. She has done very much for our cause. I should be glad to give her a short interview for her paper. Is there anywhere we could be undisturbed?"
A small anteroom was immediately placed at the Grand Duchess's disposal, and Count Streptich was dispatched to bring in Miss Montressor. As soon as he had done so, and withdrawn again, the Princess Poperensky remained in attendance. A rapid exchange of garments took place. 3 minutes later, the door opened, and the Grand Duchess emerged, a bouquet of roses held up to her face. Bowing graciously and uttering a few words of farewell to Lady Anchester in French, she passed out and entered her car, which was waiting. Princess Poperensky took her place beside her, and the car drove off.
"Well," said Jane, "that's that. I wonder how Miss Montressor's getting on." "No one will notice her. She can slip out quietly."
"That's true," said Jane. "I did it nicely, didn't I?"
"You acted your part with great distinction."
"Why isn't the Count with us?"
"He was forced to remain. Someone must watch over the safety of Her Highness."
"I hope nobody's going to throw bombs," said Jane apprehensively.
"Hi, we're turning off the main road. Why is that?"
Gathering speed, the car was shooting down a side road. Jane jumped up and put her head out of the window, remonstrating with the driver. He only laughed and increased his speed. Jane sank back into her seat again.
"Your spies were right," she said with a laugh. "We're for it, all right. I suppose the longer I keep it up, the safer it is for the Grand Duchess. At all events, we must give her time to return to London safely."
At the prospect of danger, Jane's spirits rose. She had not relished the prospect of a bomb, but this type of adventure appealed to her sporting instincts. Suddenly, with a grinding of brakes, the car pulled up in its own length. A man jumped on the step. In his hand was a revolver.
"Put your hands up," he snarled.
The Princess Poperensky's hands rose swiftly, but Jane merely looked at him disdainfully and kept her hands on her lap.
"Ask him the meaning of this outrage," she said in French to her companion.
But before the latter had time to say a word, the man broke in. He poured out a torrent of words in some foreign language. Not understanding a single thing, Jane merely shrugged her shoulders and said nothing. The chauffeur had got down from his seat and joined the other man.
"Will the illustrious lady be pleased to descend?" he asked with a grin.
Raising the flowers to her face again, Jane stepped out of the car. The Princess Poperensky followed her.
"Will the illustrious lady come this way?"
Jane took no notice of the man's mock, insolent manner, but of her own accord she walked towards a low-built, rambling house, which stood about 100 yards away from where the car had stopped. The road had been a cul-de-sac, ending in the gateway and drive which led to this apparently untenanted building. The man, still brandishing his pistol, came close behind the two women. As they passed up the steps, he brushed past them and flung open a door on the left. It was an empty room, into which a table and 2 chairs had evidently been brought. Jane passed in and sat down. Anna Mikhailovna followed her. The man banged the door and turned the key. Jane walked to the window and looked out.
"I could jump out, of course," she remarked, "but I shouldn't get far." "No, we'll just have to stay here for the present and make the best of it. I wonder if they'll bring us something to eat."
About 30 minutes later, her question was answered. A big bowl of steaming soup was brought in and placed on the table in front of her. Also 2 pieces of dry bread.
No luxury for aristocrats, evidently,
remarked Jane cheerily as the door was shut and locked again.
Will you start, or shall I?
The Princess Poperensky waved the mere idea of food aside with horror.
How could I eat? Who knows what danger my mistress might not be in?
Oh, she's all right, said Jane. It's myself I'm worrying about.
You know these people won't be at all pleased when they find they've got hold of the wrong person. In fact, they may be very unpleasant. I shall keep up the haughty Grand Duchess stunt as long as I can, and do a bunk if the opportunity offers. The Princess Poperensky offered no reply. Jane, who was hungry, drank up all the soup. It had a curious taste, but it was hot and savoury. Afterwards, she felt rather sleepy. The Princess Poperensky seemed to be weeping quietly. Jane arranged herself on her uncomfortable chair in the least uncomfortable way and allowed her head to droop. She slept. Jane awoke with a start. She had an idea that she had been a very long time asleep. Her head felt heavy and uncomfortable. And then, suddenly, she saw something that jerked her faculties wide awake again. She was wearing the flame-coloured maracane frock. She sat up and looked round her. Yes, she was still in the room in the empty house. Everything was exactly as it had been when she went to sleep, except for 2 facts. The first was that the Princess Poperensky was no longer sitting on the other chair. The second was her own inexplicable change of costume.
I can't have dreamt it, said Jane, because if I'd dreamt it, I shouldn't be here.
She looked across at the window and registered a second significant fact. When she had gone to sleep, the sun had been pouring through the window. Now the house threw a sharp shadow on the sunlit drive.
The house faces west, she reflected. It was afternoon when I went to sleep. Therefore it must be tomorrow morning now. Therefore that soup was drugged. Therefore, oh, I don't know, it all seems mad.
She got up and went to the door. It was unlocked. She explored the house. It was silent and empty. Jane put her hand to her aching head and tried to think. And then she caught sight of a torn newspaper lying by the front door. It had glaring headlines which caught her eye.
"American girl bandit in England," she read. "The girl in the red dress. Sensational hold-up at Orion House Bazaar."
Jane staggered out into the sunlight. Sitting on the steps, she read, her eyes growing bigger and bigger. The facts were short and succinct. Just after the departure of the Grand Duchess Paulina, 3 men and a girl in a red dress had produced revolvers and successfully held up the crowd. They had annexed the 100 pearls and made a getaway in a fast racing car. Up to now, they had not been traced. In the stop press, it was a late evening paper, were a few words to the effect that the girl bandit in the red dress had been staying at the Blitz as a Miss Montressor of New York.
"I'm dished," said Jane. "Absolutely dished. I always knew there was a catch in it."
And then she started. A strange sound had smote the air. The voice of a man, uttering 1 word at frequent intervals.
"Damn," it said. "Damn."
And yet again,
"Damn."
Jane thrilled to the sound. It expressed so exactly her own feelings. She ran down the steps. By the corner of them lay a young man. He was endeavouring to raise his head from the ground. His face struck Jane as one of the nicest faces she had ever seen. It was freckled and slightly quizzical in expression.
"Damn my head," said the young man. "Damn it, I—"
He broke off and stared at Jane.
"I must be dreaming," he said faintly. "That's what I said," said Jane. "But we're not. What's the matter with your head?"
"Somebody hit me on it. Fortunately, it's a thick one."
He pulled himself into a sitting position and made a wry face.
"My brain will begin to function shortly, I expect. I'm still in the same old spot, I see."
"How did you get here?" asked Jane curiously.
"Well, that's a long story. By the way,
You're not the Grand Duchess what's-her-name, are you?
I'm not. I'm plain Jane Cleveland.
You're not plain, anyway, said the young man, looking at her with frank admiration. Jane blushed.
I ought to get you some water or something, oughtn't I?
She asked uncertainly. I believe it's customary, agreed the young man. All the same, I'd rather have whiskey if you can find it. Jane was unable to find any whiskey. The young man took a deep draught of water and announced himself better. Shall I relate my adventures, or will you relate yours? He asked.
You first.
Well, there's nothing much to mine. I happened to notice that the Grand Duchess went into that room with low-heeled shoes on, and came out with high-heeled ones. It struck me as rather odd. I don't like things to be odd. I followed the car on my motorbicycle. I saw you taken into the house. About 10 minutes later, a big racing car came tearing up. A girl in red got out, and three men. She had low-heeled shoes on, all right. They went into the house. Presently, Low Heels came out dressed in black and white, and went off in the first car, with an old pussy and a tall man with a fair beard. The others went off in the racing car. I thought they'd all gone, and were just trying to get in at that window and rescue you, when someone hit me on the head from behind. That's all. Now for your turn. Jane related her adventures.
And it's awfully lucky for me that you did follow, she ended. Do you see what an awful hole I should have been in otherwise? The Grand Duchess would have had a perfect alibi. She left the bazaar before the hold-up began, and arrived in London in her car. Would anybody ever have believed my fantastic, improbable story?
Not on your life, said the young man with conviction. They had been so absorbed in their respective narratives that they had been quite oblivious of their surroundings. They looked up now with a slight start to see a tall, sad-faced man leaning against the house. He nodded at them. Very interesting, he commented.
Who are you?
Demanded Jane. The sad-faced man's eyes twinkled a little. Detective Inspector Farrell, he said gently. I've been very interested in hearing your story, young man, and this young lady's. We might have found a little difficulty in believing hers, but for one or two things.
For instance?
Well, you see, we heard this morning that the real Grand Duchess had eloped with a chauffeur in Paris. Jane gasped. And then we knew that this American girl bandit had come to this country, and we expected a coup of some kind. We'll have laid hands on them very soon, I can promise you that. Excuse me a minute, will you? He ran up the steps into the house.
Well, said Jane.
She put a lot of force into the expression.
I think it was awfully clever of you to notice those shoes, she said suddenly.
Not at all, said the young man. I was brought up in the boot trade. My father's a sort of boot king. He wanted me to go into the trade, marry and settle down, all that sort of thing. Nobody in particular, just the principle of the thing. But I wanted to be an artist. He sighed.
I'm so sorry, said Jane kindly.
I've been trying for 6 years. There's no blinking it. I'm a rotten painter. I've a good mind to chuck it and go home like the prodigal son. There's a good billet waiting for me.
A job is the great thing, agreed Jane wistfully. Do you think you could get me one, trying on boots somewhere?
I could give you a better one than that, if you'd take it.
Oh? What?
Never mind now. I'll tell you later. You know, until yesterday, I never saw a girl I felt I could marry.
Yesterday?
At the bazaar. And then I saw her. The one and only her. He looked very hard at Jane.
How beautiful the delphiniums are, said Jane hurriedly, with very pink cheeks.
They're lupins, said the young man.
It doesn't matter, said Jane.
Not a bit, he agreed. And he drew a little nearer.
We hope you've enjoyed Jane in Search of a Job, a short story by Agatha Christie, performed by Hugh Fraser. Text copyright 1971, Agatha Christie Limited. All rights reserved. Production copyright 2004, 2005, 2006, HarperCollins Publishers Limited. All rights reserved. If you've enjoyed this Agatha Christie story, don't miss The Golden Ball and other stories. Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.